Prepare yourself for the only talk radio show you'll want to turn up.
Crank this thing.
Sirius XM Pandora presents the place where your hard rock and metal voice can still be heard.
You bet your ass, baby.
Unfiltered, uncensored, say whatever you want.
Hit the record button. Anything can happen, you know?
I know that ain't nobody out there came to be mellow tonight, now did you? I say there ain't nobody. I say there ain't nobody not out there that even wants to be a little bit mellow, now is there? Anybody wants to get mellow, you can turn around and get the fuck out of here, all right?
This is the Trunk Nation Podcast with host A. Trunk.
Hey folks, it's Eddie Trunk, and this is the Eddie Trunk Podcast. New episodes every Thursday, anywhere you get your podcasts, always free. Hope you're doing well, hope you're having a good week, and thank you for joining me for another episode of the podcast, which, as I tell you every episode, originates from my Sirius XM radio show, which is called Trunk Nation, and can be heard Monday through Friday on channel 106 volume, live 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern time, nightly re-airs 10 to midnight Eastern. Full shows, audio, video, more, anytime you want on the Sirius XM app. If you're in the U.S. or Canada and you're only listening to the podcast, you are getting like one-fifth, one-sixth of what I do on a weekly basis on the radio. So be sure to join me on Sirius XM Radio for Trunk Nation 6 times a week live on 106 and, of course, a sixth show over on 39 Hair Nation. Thank you all for tuning in. Thank you all for joining me, and a lot of stuff going on, man. My travel schedule is nuts. Be sure to follow me on social media, especially Twitter, where I am most active, at Eddie Trunk, Instagram as well. I'll keep you updated with everything that I have going on. If you're listening to this on post day, which is Thursday, which would be the 11th of November, well, first of all, Veterans Day, happy Veterans Day, and thank you, sincere thanks and gratitude to all our veterans. As I always say, the true rock stars. So thank you, veterans. And also, just giving you context for today, let me tell you what's going on. Tomorrow, I'll be hosting the LA Guns record release party, Palm Springs, California, Indio to be exact, Fantasy Springs Casino, free and open to the public. Also, coming up on Monday, a public funeral for Frankie Benali that I will be hosting, Forest Lawn in Hollywood, 2:30, open to the public, first come, first serve, as far as capacity at the chapel. That is coming up this Monday. That will also be streamed, and you can get the link to stream that on the Quiet Riot website. You can watch that way as well if you're not in Southern California. Also excited this weekend, I'm going to go see Rival Sons, one of my favorite newer bands. That's this Saturday, Anaheim House of Blues. Keep up with all my stuff, like I said, on social media. If you do listen to Volume and Trunk Nation every day, we got the Aussie Top 20 coming up this coming Monday, so a lot of good stuff going on. So the interviews this week on the podcast you're about to hear, these happened about a week ago, a little over a week ago, and this was the first time, and I can't tell you how long, I was in New York City at the Sirius XM headquarters. Of course, the buildings had closed because of COVID. They're kind of partially reopened right now. And I went into the building for the first time in ages a week ago Tuesday. And I figured if I'm going to do a show from New York City, why not make it very New York-centric? And that's exactly what this is, with two New York City natives, JJ French, founding member of Twisted Sister, later, and joining me right at the top of the show and for the entire show was my dear friend Frank Bello of Anthrax. The common connection between them, beyond the fact they're both from New York, is they both have brand new books out. Frank has a book, his autobiography, which has just come out, which is fantastic. And JJ has a book that came out a few weeks ago called Twisted Business, also a great read. So both were promoting books. Both are two of the few artists still remaining in the New York City area, and both old friends. And it was a fun hang, as you're about to hear. Frank Bello, then later joined by JJ French of Twisted Sister. Enjoy it. It's coming up on this week's Eddie Trunk Podcast. All right, let's get to it. Going into the Sirius XM headquarters in New York City for the first time in ages And joining me in the studio, first Frank Bello, then JJ from Twisted Sister comes in. This is how that fun hang and conversation in the studio went. Both of them promoting new books. You'll hear all about it. Let's check it out on this week's podcast. All right. He survived the train. I was saying before you got here, Frank Bello is here. I said before you got here, you know, you and I were texting about this. Like, you know, you were like, I don't want to make you schlep into the city. I'm like, well, I don't want to make you schlep into the city. We could put the mic in front of you. What are you doing? You don't have the mic. You don't know where to work a mic. You've been singing for 40 years.
I'm new to this.
But here we are.
We're back.
We're back in the New York groove. Got in a fight on the train, or you watched someone almost get a fight.
It was so close. And being a New Yorker, as you know, Eddie, I just don't want any problems. I don't want any problems with anybody. I just want to go to the train. I don't want to take a car in because you know the city with the traffic. I don't want to deal with this shit.
I do that. I'm the asshole that takes the car.
Oh, I am not.
It cost me $65.
That's ridiculous. Yeah. So Metro North. So I do that all the time. I come in, sit in my seat in the corner so no asshole could be near me. Of course, the asshole has to come near me without a ticket. So the conductor, the poor guy, is just trying to make a fucking living. He's just trying to make a living. He comes up, ticket, I give him my ticket. Next booth over, next seat over is the guy. The guy that refuses to buy a ticket, but he's going to be adamant about not giving him a ticket. So I need your ticket, and then you have to get off the next stamp. I'll get off when I have to. Right? It's like that. All of a sudden,
the attitude, everybody pushing the edge. I said before you came in, I said, we have a very New York show today because it's the first time in the New York City headquarters in a long time.
Awesome.
And then the guests are you and JJ, two quintessential New York guys who are just, you know, we're all fucking on the edge.
And I am on the edge right now.
This city will do it to you.
Yeah,
you know,
it'll
do it. You don't even have for 2 seconds, it gets you like that.
And then I'm running here I'm running through the Diamond District like an idiot with a bag of books. Like, I stole diamonds. I look like a freaking lunatic. What the hell's going on, man? But welcome, Eddie.
Thank you, Frank.
Same here, bro.
It's good to see you.
Everywhere.
We just saw each other.
Yes.
For Oklahoma.
Yes.
On Labor Day weekend.
Which was a blast.
Anthrax turned in a great set. We hung out all day.
That was a nice hang. You know, coming from where we come from now, nobody knows anybody anymore. It's so sterile backstage.
Yeah.
That's what's crazy about what's going on. Very thankful to play some shows. But when you go backstage, you know it. It's very sterile. You have to be really careful. Who's appropriate? You have to take down the mask. Do I put up the mask?
Well, every band's got different rules.
Yeah,
just came off my busiest month of my life in October.
I see. Yeah.
And everywhere I went, every band, every city, every venue, every gig is different. You've got to adapt. Now you tell me if you feel this too, and I'm just saying the truth.
Yeah.
And I'm not in any way diminishing COVID, and again, I take it seriously, and I'm vaxxed, and I got no problem, and I'll whatever. But I also believe you got to live. So, but you do, and I have seen at gigs that COVID has also become a really great excuse for a lot of things.
Oh yeah.
Like, you don't want to do a meet and greet. You don't want to see somebody. Well, I'm not talking you.
No, not me.
I'm talking
about, I love everybody.
But I'm just talking in general. Like, I've been at shows, I'm not going to name names, where the band is like, we're locked down, we're not seeing anybody. And then they see the person they want to see at the corner, dude, come back. And you see him back there with no mask, yapping it up. So it's just like, telling the big boss here in the corner, I'm like, I fly a lot. And since I fly so much, I'm often in business because I get bumped up.
Cool.
Used to be you get nice food and whatever. Now, like, they brought me the lunch and the bread was wrapped in cellophane like it was a nuclear bomb, like to be insulated. And then the salad comes, and it's in a bowl, unwrapped, just sitting there, greens, like out in the air. Like, what's the difference?
It's like it's specifics. It's all specifics. This is good. This is bad.
It's madness. It's out of control. None of it makes sense.
We all want to be careful. Look, I have a son. You have children, blah, blah, blah. We all want to be careful for our families. I get it. But at the same time, you do have to live.
You got to live.
Yeah, it's common sense.
Do the best you can and get by.
Everybody live their life.
See where it goes. That's all you can do. So the book.
Yes. It's very weird to be here on a book, Eddie.
The author, Frank Bello.
No,
all the decades I've known him, the author, Frank Bello, is here. The book, it's out now. It's actually out now.
Literally today.
That's right, because we talked about it. Today's the release date.
Today's the release date of the book, Fathers, Brothers, and Sons. Look, I'm new to this, guys, so have patience with me. I'm learning how to do. I know records. I know how to release records and do that stuff. Releasing your life in a book is really scary. I'm raw, Eddie. That's as raw as you're ever going to see me. A lot of the stuff you probably didn't know about me.
Well, you're right. I've known you, like, I feel like my whole life, but literally, I was thinking about easily 40 years.
Yeah.
40 years. And as much as I know you, there's things I learned in this book having read it. But here's the other thing. I remember when you were writing this book, and we were talking, and you had picked my brain.
I needed it.
Because I did a couple books, but they weren't this kind of book. Eventually, I will do this kind of book.
But my books
are more about the bands I love and stuff like that. But you were saying to me about some of the things in here that you were, I guess, I don't know, apprehensive, concerned about, like, should I go there? Should I open up? Should I, how raw should I get? You were really on the fence about that.
I was.
And I told you that I thought whatever you were comfortable with, you should.
Exactly.
So tell me how you wrestled with all that. And because for people that don't know, so Frank's book is subtitled Surviving Anguish, Abandonment, and Anthrax. So the anguish is the murder of your brother,
sure,
which is covered in the book.
Yes.
And the abandonment is your father.
Exactly.
So those are heavy things that you had to get into in here.
Yeah. Because, I mean, look, a lot of people are hurting, and a lot of people have written me about this because they know my story. And I found during COVID, it was the right time. Joel McIver, my co-writer, we've been talking about doing this for 8 years. 8 years. And this was the time. We finally decided this is the time, this downtime. And I needed this. I needed to get it out cathartically. You know, it was very freeing, and I needed you, and I thank you for this. This is not a kiss ass to you. I needed that validation when you gave me it and said, go with what you're comfortable. And I just thought, man, if I can help other people that are going through, like, whatever, loss, there's a lot of stuff in the book, loss, abandonment, all those issues, and know that you can brush yourself off, and at the end of the day, you can rally. Yeah, and I'm lucky enough to be in a band and successful and all that stuff. Thankfully, I'm very grateful for that. But I want to show people that, yeah, you get hit down enough times, you could still get up and brush yourself off. I think in these times specifically, I'm not just using this time, just it's important to know that you can get up and move on. And I want people to know that. It's not just, and yeah, there's a lot of great rock and roll stories, the Pantera stuff, the Kiss stuff, all these great rock and roll stories that we put out and I dug out of my head through Joel. Joel's a great igniter of lighting stories under my ass. And once they started and they just kept flowing out and even reliving this, it was a lot of fun to relive the Pantera stories with Dimebag and the Kiss stories, harassing Kiss in front of a coin management on Madison Avenue, not far from here.
Yep. That was amazing to me. And I told Frank, you know, I get so many books and I try to read them when I want to read every book before I talk to the person who wrote it about it, obviously. But I'm literally reading them so much that sometimes things get jumbled and you forget.
Sure.
But so I read your book a little while ago, but the stuff in there about so the guy that you stalked Kiss with is a mutual friend of ours.
Stalked is a strong word. I'm afraid to use that word.
Well,
I don't want a negative content. You know,
right.
You know, I don't want that.
But Gene, well, that's Tom Brown, our friend Tom.
Our friend Tom.
But Gene, talk about going full circle.
Totally, dude.
So you're the guy that's literally hanging out in front of these studios and management offices to meet Kiss, which is all of our common bond being Kiss fans. And who writes the foreword to your book?
Amazing.
Than Gene Simmons.
You can't go more
full circle than
not
that.
Not at all. And the way, if you read the foreword by Gene, it's Gene talking as I've read a lot of interviews with Gene and I've talked to him a lot. I've never heard him speak like this about his dad, about his upbringing. And he goes deep and it really touched me.
I agree. I thought that was really interesting is that it's very different voice for Gene.
Absolutely.
You know, and he's connecting with you on that same level of your dad abandoning you.
Absolutely.
And that bond and that connection. But you actually met, now this is what I didn't know, because I told Frank, I said, as long as we've been friends, there's things in the book that I learned. Correct me if I'm wrong on the timeline, but you actually met Gene before when they were still wearing makeup, right?
Oh yeah, no doubt, dude.
Without makeup,
this was, dude. I'm sorry.
Like he brought you into the studio, right? Were they making Unmasked or something?
That was, I remember that story. What album was Young and Wasted on?
Lick It Up.
Lick
so
It Up.
So they're without makeup, but you wouldn't have seen them.
You wouldn't have seen them yet, right? So this was a quick story from the book. Remember Right Track Studios on 48th Street?
Yeah, I go there all the time.
Of course. So Tom, my friend, you know Tom.
That's literally one street over.
One
from
street
where
over.
Sitting.
It's when it was very close to here. So
it's all knocked down now, though.
Tommy got a call, as he did. Tommy got a call that. Go ahead. We want to explain.
No, but so Tommy. So people that don't know, Tommy is our mutual friend, Tom Brown. He's not in the music industry,
not at all.
Just a friend of ours. And Frankie grew up. You guys grew up together.
Yes.
So how was, because you got to remember, this is before text, email, cell phone,
all of that.
How was Tom getting
phone calls.
This guy had
being
connections.
Tipped off about Kiss's whereabouts.
I don't know how he got the connections. This is what Tommy would do. He would call me during the day and before school and stuff, like, hey, I just got a tip. Literally, I just got a tip. They're going to be in today. That means they're going to be in the management in front. They have a meeting scheduled, and this is January, February, dude, freezing our balls off. So we go downtown on Manhattan Express, me and Tom, I cut out of school, go down and wait, literally wait with our jackets shivering in front of a coin management and wait for, we didn't know what they really looked like. We'd wait for these big, tall guys with suits on, with long hair, with masks. That's what they did in those days. With the
they
high
wore
heels.
A mask?
In those days, it was 77, 78. I'm talking about that specific time. So they would walk in, and obviously, who else is going to walk in like that? So Tommy, right away, Tommy and I were right up. We asked every question.
But wait, question. Did they wear bandanas or anything? Or did they cover their faces or no?
When they walked, when they knew they were going to be known, when the press was around sometimes, they would cover their faces because they didn't want to get pictures. Remember in those days?
Right.
So they would, if they knew press and people with cameras, they would cover their faces either with their hands or wear a mask or a bandana. Those were great times. We knew it. So we got this time. We got 1,000 signatures from these guys, 1,000. But every time they signed, we'd get to ask them questions and more questions. So everything was Kiss. What's the new album like? How many songs? When's the new tour? What are your costumes going to be like? What's the new staging? Everything in a row. And we used to have those high, annoying voices. Ching, 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 ching. And Tommy had this great high, annoying. Ching, 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 ching. And I remember Tommy kept patting Paul on the back. Hey, Paul, you sound so great on the radio. And dude, Paul was getting, he was like, what are you doing, dude? It was so great, the times of my life. But after a while, you know, you go through this life and we get the whole Anthrax thing. Gene, Paul, they still remember those days. Specifically Gene remembers these days to this day. It's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
It's an awesome
It had to
thing.
Mean a lot to you that he agreed to do this. How'd you approach him about doing it? And did he ask for money?
My co-writer, Joel, asked me, I said, if you can get him to do that, absolutely. And so he approached him and he did. He was more than happy to do it. And he did a great, I actually couldn't believe when I was reading the words, he was talking about me. He was talking about my bass playing and the whole father thing. It was very big for me. You have to understand. So I think Kiss fans, I'm not trying to sell the book. Well, I am trying to sell the book, but I think they'd appreciate it just that alone and then going into my Kiss fandom.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole thing.
But he doesn't get a point or anything on the book. For
not yet, unless they sign something I don't know about. You never know. Did I sign anything? No. You could go into the whole thing.
So here's the deal. So this book is interesting in a lot of ways, because it's Frank's story. It's his family growing up, his dad abandoning him, his brother tragically being murdered. All of this is covered in the book. So in a way, the book actually takes you on a roller coaster.
It does. It's a ride.
And your life was a roller coaster. I mean, we're not talking about this. This is not fiction. This is something that you dealt with.
It's all real.
And for as much as there's funny stuff about running after Kiss in New York as a kid and all that, There's tough things in here for you to deal with. And one of the things that you cover in this book is about your brother when he was murdered and the actions you took. And I know you were on the fence about whether you should go there.
Right.
But since it's in the book.
It's in the
book. I'm not saying anything that you didn't go public with. But what you would imagine how that would sit with you and what you almost did. Can you talk a little bit about that without giving too much in the book? Because you almost did something that you might not be sitting here with me right now if you did.
I'd either be dead or in jail. Either one. That's the guy. Eddie, you know me a long time. I don't bullshit. I don't lie. I don't make things up. After Anthony's death, I didn't know how to deal with it. Quite honestly, I went dark. I've come through this through a lot of therapy. And you didn't know this about me. Teresa, my wife, didn't know this. I didn't tell anybody in my family what happened after Anthony's death. So it envisions
I didn't
in my
even
head.
Know what was that it was happening at the time it was happening.
Yeah.
Because I knew you then. I mean, I didn't realize you were in that dark of a place.
It was because I can be the nice guy, but the other side. And dude, to tell you the truth, I didn't even know that was me. But I had this vengeance thing. I became, and I swear to God, Eddie, as I'm speaking, I became the hunter where 10 o'clock, it was literally 10 o'clock, 10:30 at night. I knew the specific areas in the Bronx where these people hung out.
That you suspected killed your brother.
Well, I knew. I knew a lot of the people around the area. See, there were a lot of witnesses. This sounds like a Law and Order film, right?
This is real life.
It's real life.
But back up a second, Frank. Yeah, for people who haven't read the book, your brother, tell them the circumstances surrounding your brother being murdered.
March 25th, 1996, my brother Anthony was 23 years old. In the Bronx, New York, he was shot down from an assailant. Long story short, there were a lot of witnesses, but they all backed out because they were afraid they were going to get you know,
repercussions.
That's probably a better word to go there. Yeah. So there was going to be repercussions. So there was one witness, and they took us to the Bronx criminal court system that I don't wish on my worst enemy. They brought us through the whole Bronx criminal court system, and it was the good guys on one side, the bad guys on the other side, and the bad guys were trying to stare us down, want to starting fights in the court.
It's literally like something out of a movie.
It was like I use this a lot in the book. It's like a Scorsese movie. This was the truth, and they put us in the same elevator with the killer's family. I mean, so for me again, and you have to say the accused killers, right? You have to say that, but we all know. But I'll leave it there. So after that, after seeing my brother on their sheet, I snapped, Eddie. I'm being really honest. I snapped, and I haven't told my wife this. I hadn't told my mom. I haven't told anybody in my family. I came out of my condo in Yonkers at 10:30 every night, sweated up, sweatshirt, hood, hat, the whole thing, man. I didn't look like me. Didn't give a shit about anything, Frank Bello from Anthrax or anything. Nothing mattered. It was tunnel vision. I was on a mission. I talked to the wrong guys. You're looking at me like you can't believe
him. No, it's not that at all.
This is true.
But Frank, I'm looking at you in a way saying to myself, I don't know if I could be that much different than what you just did.
Yes.
Because we're wired very similar, you and
totally
I. We've talked
are.
About it for decades.
Absolutely.
You know, I consider you like a brother.
And
I
you
really
are
do.
Brother to me. It's
you're
totally.
The same here. So yeah. We have, beyond all the same music we love, we've had, for people listening, I mean, Frank and I talk off there. I tell people
close.
All the time, like, if I was in the business of flipping burgers, I know the people would still be my friends. You're one of those people.
Absolutely.
So our connection is way beyond the music thing. And I we're very similar in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So what I'm looking at you is saying, I can't tell you I'd be any different if I went through this.
So you know that dark place that you're feeling right now? I went 100% full in on that. And because nothing mattered, my family didn't matter, Teresa didn't matter, my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, nothing mattered. So I went dark. I never talked to these people, Eddie. I went to the wrong people, getting the wrong things in my hands, and you don't know what I'm talking about. Checking
weapons.
Things, weapons. I never did. I never fired
so
a gun.
So you went to you never fired a gun, and you went to take revenge. You went, look, you're in New York City. You get whatever you want to get, like an unmarked gun or
matter
something
of fact,
like that. Was that what you're trying
of,
to do?
It was totally unmarked. It was filed.
Did you actually get it?
I didn't buy it. I didn't buy it. I told him I'd be back, but then I kept hunting. I wanted them to make sure I had the right target. This sounds crazy. I know that. I wanted to be sure until I got the target where that person was going to be. And this is how crazy it was. I saw black, dude. I'm telling you, I just saw nothing, but it had to happen. 2 weeks of doing this, then I was ready to do it. Payments were going to happen. I had the dough on me and all that stuff.
You going to do it yourself or are you going to hire
all
someone?
All me. Fuck that. All me.
So what do you mean payments were going to happen to who?
I was going to pay for the gun.
Oh, the piece.
I was going to, all because you had to have cash and all that stuff.
Right.
I had to check out, make sure I asked this other guy, if he was real, if he's the real dude and he's not going to get me in trouble, all that shit on the other side, right? So I had to check all of it out. So finally, when I did that, parading around, about 2 weeks into doing this, and this one specific area, man, I just kind of thought, I don't know where it came from. My mom started coming into my head. I said, look, if I do this, there's no way it's going to end good. I either am going to wind up dead, which is more than likely dead because of the retribution. Retribution, more than likely I've been dead. And that's not to sound like a tough guy. Or you'd be in jail, you know, the other side of it, right? So either way, my mom loses a son, another son,
right
after the tragic death of my brother. That kind of pulled me out. And then I thought, look, I'm going to lose my family, my wife, who's going to be my wife, Teresa, was my girlfriend at the time, and then anthrax. All this thing started coming. I said, what are you doing? And then I thought of my brother saying to me, slapping me. He said, what the bitch slapping me? I said, what the fuck are you thinking? Get back home. You know, I really thought this. He would never want that. He would never. I mean, Anthony would kick the shit out of me if he knew what I was doing. And it just didn't make sense. And I was so happy because, Eddie, when I tell you I was this close, when the money was out and all that stuff and I had it targeted, that's as scared as I've ever been of not knowing who I was. That's as honest as I can be with that because it went dark. Nothing, when I say nothing mattered because all I want, and it didn't matter if I died. It didn't fucking matter because it was all about easing that pain that I felt and my family felt. I needed something back, and that's the truth. I'm glad it didn't happen. because I wouldn't be here, and I wouldn't have my son, the whole thing, the whole game. You lose everything. But I never talked about that. And I brought it in the book because I thought it was important for people who are in dark times and knowing they can get out of it before making a move. And that's the truth. Because I don't want people to go there. I mean, there's so much fucking pain out there right now. And why not come out with a book that just says, look, brush yourself off and fucking move on to tomorrow. That's what, for me, it's not a self-help thing. I'm not preaching. I don't give a shit.
Right.
It's my story. It's my story that if it could help one person that buys a book, then it's done its job.
The last thing on this part of the book, because obviously there's a lot to this, and make no mistake, the book has all the great Anthrax stories, yeah. And you've got the stuff with Dime, and you've got the Kiss stuff and all the great stories in there. But it's been a little bit since I read the book, and mm-hmm. I read the PDF you sent, so it's the first time I'm seeing it here physically. But you say, I believe you say something in the book like the person that you are certain did this, that you know their whereabouts now, right? That they moved out of the area or something like that?
I don't know the exact area, but I know where they moved. Because you find out. Look, when you're a neighborhood guy, you're a neighborhood guy. That's just the way it works. You hear things. You can take it with a grain of salt, or you can believe the truth. There's some people that I know that I trust that have told me the truth. And that's fine. It's, now I have to live on this because that's what my therapist says. I have to live on karma. Karma. You know, I believe what comes around goes around. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I said in this book, I was never going to even come close to saying anything about this because it's a dangerous subject.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about. Did you have, because I know you, when you and I talked, when you were writing it, we talked about it. And yeah. I said, Frank, whatever you're comfortable with, you should go there that you feel good about putting out there. But was there a chance that when you were writing this, that you weren't going to put that in there at all?
Yeah, totally. And when I talked to you, and that's the truth, Eddie, when I talked to you, it kind of said, I have to do this. It's the story of my brother. It's the real story of my family, the pain we went through.
Yeah.
People are going through tough times. If they can relate to that and knowing that we can come out of it. And that's what this is, man. It's kind of like a celebration. Like, look, through my health, through my strong family, through those ties and keeping the strong women in my life, they kept my head together. And that's the truth, man. Because otherwise, it was Frank going off the edge and maybe probably not here. And I'm not even to sound like a fucking hero or anything. It's
right,
just
no,
the
I got
truth.
You. Yeah, yeah.
You know?
And when you talk about the strong women in your life, I mean, you know, there's great stories in there about the family, your family and everything. And
yeah.
The, you know, I mean, again, being myself being raised in a totally dominant Italian household and yeah. My mom being 100%, that upbringing and that family structure around you and food and dinners and all that, it's just such a big important part of the dynamic as well. One of the real interesting things in the book, because of course all the Anthrax stuff I pretty much lived,
sure,
but the and it's all great stuff, but the thing is that I was interested in reading about, and I know you did talk about it, is when you left Anthrax,
yeah,
and you played in Helmet.
Yeah.
For people that don't know, Frankie was out of Anthrax for how long?
Year and a half.
Was it that short of a time?
Year and
it
half,
felt
2 years.
Longer.
It felt longer, but I think it was a year and a half, 2 years. Probably two, more closer to 2 years.
It was so weird for us, who are your friends, that you weren't in the band.
I know.
Because when you think about it, so Frank tells the story in the book about getting in the band, which you were just kind of the kid hanging out, and Dan Lilker didn't do it anymore, and how you end up just, you tell that story, because when you got in the band, it was, I remember that's in the book, you just, you kind of got thrown into the fire a little bit, didn't
totally.
You?
Well, Lamour's was my first show, remember? Yeah. So that was, it's still on YouTube. I watched it. It scared the shit out of me all over again.
You were like 18.
Dude, 18. It was nuts. A big packed show for Anthrax and stuff. So I remember, I don't know if I say this in the book, I got this pain. You ever have a burning in your neck? Like when you headbang? And I remember I had this, I thought I snapped my neck in the first song, Death Rider. Right in, high on it! I'm headbanging. I said, I heard this. I said, what the fuck is that? I'm like a headbanger just trying to keep going. I'm not going to fuck up my first show. Felt this fucking burning going up and down my head. I said, did I snap my neck? Am I going to have to go to the hospital? I mean, all these things throughout the first song, Death Rider. I said, please, God, let me just get through this. Long story short, I put ice on it afterwards. It wasn't broken or anything like that. I must have pulled some kind of muscle, but I really thought I snapped something. That was my first show. I definitely had some shit in my pants. There's no doubt in my There's no doubt for that. You probably see it on stage in that video on YouTube. You could probably watch it. Frank's shitting in his pants right there.
I didn't know that was on YouTube. I have to look at that. I may have even been there for all I know. I don't know.
Me with my Guido haircut. It was awesome.
But then you there was a brief time that you were out of the band and you were playing in Helmet. And you talk about that very positively. You
totally
enjoyed doing that.
It was a total
positive. I came to see you do that. I remember here in New York.
It was awesome. I loved it. It was a great time. You know, and the truth of the matter is, and you could ask Charlie and Scott this, we just needed space. We needed time apart. We were together. We were arguing. And we decided, look, we just need a break. So Joey Vera took my place in Anthrax. He's a great friend of mine. I love Joey. He played bass in Anthrax. Johnny Tempesta called me up a couple of weeks later. He heard about it. He says, come out and jam with Helmet. 37 songs in, we started jamming. Paige asked me to learn 37 songs just to hang out. So we did, and it worked, and it was a great time. It was a great time, and I also think it made me a better bass player.
Yeah.
It did. It made me really sink in and dive into the pick. I really enjoyed it.
It was just so weird, though, because Joey's great. Nothing gets Joey Love Bear Joey. Or anything, but it just like was, and going to see Anthrax is like, the ball buster's not here. Where is he? Like, this can't be happening.
Well, you know what's even better? I went to see Anthrax without me in L.A. With my friend Clint. And when I was on tour with Helmet, we had a night off. Anthrax was playing in L.A. with Joey Vera. Well, my friends. So imagine, I say this in the book. So imagine, I didn't want anybody to feel bad. Anybody to feel weird, because Joey's a tight friend of me. I love him. And the guys, I know it must have felt weird when I walked in. I just immediately walked in. Hey, you know, I hugged everybody. And then after everything was good, everything was calm, then I just went up to my seat, dude, and I watched Anthrax. My first Anthrax show. Really, it was awesome. I loved it. I thought it was awesome.
That's a weird thing when you think about it. Like, I read a book. I forget what Aerosmith book it was. Joe Perry went to see Aerosmith without him when he wasn't in. Joey Kramer watched Aerosmith play once with another drummer. Like, it's one thing not being in the band, but watching it. I remember Udo told me he went to see Accept with Mark singing.
How was that for him?
I imagine it wasn't great. I mean, Mark's great, but I imagine for Udo, it probably wasn't great. But
I loved it. Joey did a great job. I thought it was him and Bush. Bush was singing. Right. So it was like half of Armored Saint, too. It's kind of cool seeing that whole Anthrax Armored Saint. It was cool. It sounded great. Joey played all the bass parts right. It was all good. So why not, dude? Life is short.
Yeah, yeah. The book is called Fathers, Brothers, and Sons, Surviving Anguish, Abandonment, and Anthrax by Frank Bello with Joel MacGyver. And it's out today with a foreword by Gene Simmons. How great is that?
That's awesome.
Now, what do we got going on? We got to go to break, Joel, or what? Am I right now?
Yeah.
Because you're not playing the music, are you?
Not yet.
All right, because I'm just making sure my headphones are working. I haven't been in the studio in a long time.
Friday, Eddie, I'm doing an appearance Friday.
I was going to ask you.
Yeah, Revolution Records in the City.
All right.
I'm doing Friday at 7 p.m. Everybody come out. It's free. Doing Q&As, maybe some acoustic songs, have some fun. Some ball busting and some stuff about the book. Come on out, Revolution Records, 7 p.m. Friday night.
Where is that?
It's down in it's down way downtown near God, I forgot where it was.
Just Google it.
Just
Revolution
Google it.
Revolution Records here in New York City, 7 o'clock this Friday,
Thompson Street.
Go meet Frank, get the book, get it signed, and you're gonna love this read. It's really, really great.
Thanks, Eddie.
I really, really enjoyed it. Yes. Hold on. I told everybody it's going to be the most New York. This is the most New York day. You want to be back in New York? This is the most New York day you could ever have. JJ's here. JJ French, Frank Bello, and me. But wait, before we even get back to this, so we were just talking. So the reason we were talking off the air is JJ, for those, and you've seen it because JJ does a podcast now. There's photos, whatever. But JJ now has a shaved head. But
looks
what
awesome.
We didn't learn, Frank and I just learned during the commercial break, is that you've had a shaved head for like 40 years. We just didn't know it.
No idea.
Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, it wasn't always, because there was a lot of hair left.
Mm-hmm.
As years went by, less and less and less of it was mine. You know, people say to me, you know, who does your, what was the line? How much did you pay to get your hair done? And I said, there was like some joke I would make about it, like to kind of just think that it would just be passed off, you know, like, there's hair in the sink. Well, it's not mine. So, you know, it's like somebody. So it just, yeah. So one time, I mean, look, standing between Mendoza and D, if you look at the photos of the band, and I'm right in between the two of them, it was like in between two Chia Pets, you know, and it was only getting worse as years went by. So I had to get more and more and more and more. So when you look at the cover of Come Out and Play and all that shit, you know, a lot of it was at that point starting to be reconstructed.
Wow. And you did that. I never knew. Yeah. Never. It awesome. Great. It looks great.
What I said. Joel, is my thing working right? I'm in one channel in my headphones all of a sudden for some reason. I don't know why.
It's just a loose thing.
Okay. What I'm saying, though, as how when I said coming out of the break, you may have heard me say to Frankie, do you know how old JJ is? Because I say that because it's remarkable because how good you look, but you're about to be 70,
no,
right?
I will be. I'm 69. Well,
God bless you,
I'll
dude.
Be 70 next year. Next
you look
year
great.
Be
that's
big,
not a kiss ass.
We'll be, but you know, we'll be a big thing. Well, look, though, to be fair and honest and all that other cliche, if you look at the four bands out of 73, the four bands that started in 73, Kiss started in 73, Priest started in 73, AC/DC started in 73, Twisted started in 73. Wow. We're all 70.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's amazing.
We're all
amazing.
20. You know, we were all 20 in 73 when we all started. And
awesome.
Now, I mean, Gene is 72.
Yeah, Gene's 72. So. Read that. Yeah,
Gene's 72. Yeah. And I'm sure, you know, the guys in AC/DC are 70. So, I mean, you know.
It's awesome.
Well, that's a great way to jump in on JJ's book because we covered Frank's book, which is mm-hmm. out today. JJ, your book is out now, right?
Yes, it
Twisted
is.
Twisted Business. Yeah. And one of the stories that JJ finally, and Frank can relate to this being us being such big Kiss fans, that JJ finally sets the record straight on the in his book on the history, the arc, the lineage of exactly what went on, because there was always that thing like, JJ was supposed to be in Kiss.
Right.
That's not exactly what happened, but you did play with them.
Well,
because you this is all covered in the book.
It's all covered in the book. It started innocently enough in an elevator conversation with a lawyer whose daughter I used to babysit for in the building. His name was Peter Thall, very famous entertainment lawyer. But this is 1972, and I had just stopped doing drugs a couple of months earlier. So now I'm completely straight, like not. Dealing, going to the book with the whole dealing and the drug addiction,
which I want to touch on too, because
so
it's something else.
It was like it was a crazy life, you know. And I was totally straight. I was trying to figure out what to do. I'm trying to figure out what to do with my life, you know. And I really didn't know. And I was transitioning from a Grateful Dead head to an Allman Brothers freak into like this Bowie-ish glam thing, which I didn't quite, you know. This was early in '72, and Peter Thall said, but I'm still looking like the Grateful Dead, you know. So Peter Thall says. You want to be in a band. I'm representing a producer who has a band, and you're interested in auditioning. I went, sure. He said, good. Here's the producer's name, Ron Johnson. Give him a call. I call him up. He says, I got a band called Wicked Lester. I went, okay. What do they sound like? He said, Looking Glass. Like, you know, Brandy, you're a fine girl.
That's an accurate description of what Wicked Lester sounded like.
Yeah, it's exactly what they were.
Yeah.
That's exactly why they weren't going to be Wicked Lester anymore. Because Gene even said it to me when I met. So I called, I guess, Gene, and he says, are you playing? I can see you play. And I said, yeah, I'm playing this weekend at a church. I'm jamming in a band at a church on 6th Avenue and 12th Street. The band was called Scout. The drummer of the band was Doan Perry, who wound up being Jethro Tull's drummer for about 22 years, as a matter of fact. But we're all 20-year-old kids. And Gene and Paul come down, and I'm jamming on stage, and I walk to the back of the church, and they're standing there. And Gene says, so what's your name? I said, John Segal. And he goes, yeah. It's too Jewish, man. and you know, now let me just say, being a Jew but not being a religious Jew in any manner, I'm so reformed, I'm almost Catholic. My parents were like non-religious, completely non-religious. And I had all my Jewish Catholic, Roman Catholic friends. The only religion we ever had was the religion of drugs. That was it. You know, if you had the right drugs and at the right party and you listened to the right music, we were friends. Nobody talked religion. I never had anyone say anything about Jewishness to me, let alone a Jew
right.
saying anything Heim about Witz Jewishness
telling
to
you
me.
It's too Jewish.
So I was like, too Jewish? He goes, yeah, yeah. He goes, you know, like we're changing our names. He goes, you know, so I'm Gene Klein. I'm changing it to Gene Simmons. I said, like the actress? And he said, no. I happen to be a fan of Kim Simmons, the guitar player from...
Canadian dude, Go For A Soda. Doobie Brothers.
Kim Simmons, the British guitar player from Savoy Brown. It was the lead guitar player of Savoy Brown. It was Kim Simmons. And I go, that's interesting.
Mm. Mitchell, I was thinking, For A Soda, the Canadian dude. I got the right name.
So I thought, you know, obviously, if he's referencing Savoy Brown, they're referencing British bands, you know, which they were heavily influenced by, as we all were, mm-hmm. you know, heavily influenced by. So I went, okay, cool. And he goes, and this is Stanley Eisen. He's changing his to Paul Stanley. I went, okay. He goes, so I suggest, you know, you change your name. And he goes, take your glasses off. I go, why? He says, you look too Jewish. I was like, okay, take my glasses off. Now, so then he goes, listen, here's a tape. Hands me a reel-to-reel tape. He goes, this is Wicked Lester. Kind of sounds like Looking Glass. We're not going to be this. If I invite you to a rehearsal, you're going to be like a friend. You're going to come down. You're going to meet these other guys in the band. They're going to have beards. They're all being fired. None of them know it. They're all gone. I went, cool. So I go down.
Couldn't hear Gene's doing this too.
So
Gene wrote the foreword to Frank's book, by the way.
So I go down, and they're all there with beards, and you know, but not Paul and Gene. I was like, okay, cool. So then I jammed with them for a couple of times during a couple of weeks, and
you remember, were you playing covers or originals when you were jamming?
Oh, I did Zeppelin.
You played Zeppelin.
Oh hell cool. Yeah! Okay. Yeah, we did Zeppelin right away. And they also said, "Do you know what who Slade is?" And I went, "I kind of think." And they said, "Well, they wear platform shoes." And the whole thing was going to be, you know, we want to go for this English thing. Oh, okay. So that's why I got the Anglos thing. You know, I've told this story a million times. And when I tell it to Jewish friends of mine who are very Jewish, they go, it's self-hating Jews. This is like an example of self-hating Jews. I said, well, it's no different than every movie producer who said, change your name from, you know, whatever in the Midwest to a Clark Gable or a fancy. I didn't take it in that way. Mm-hmm. I just took it as a marketer. Like Gene was a marketer. Let's be honest, he was showing that trait back then, so it never bothered me.
One of the great things in the book, when you mentioned the Grateful Dead, because I just finished reading your book like a day ago, one of the great things in the book is the fact you talk about, so I of course I've known you a very, very long time, but I didn't know you in the early 70s when you're talking about, because people make this mistake all the time about Twisted Sister. There's two big mistakes that they make. They think the Twisted Sister started around 1983, when in fact it started in 1973. And they think that Dee Snider is the original guy of Twisted Sister, when in fact it's JJ who founded the band. And there were like 15 versions of Twisted Sister before the one everybody knows. But I did not know until I read your book of your, lack of a better word, proclivity for drugs.
Oh, that, you could say it. I'd say it right out. I was a drug dealer.
But you were a drug dealer and a drug user.
Supplied and
usually you
don't
use your supply. Isn't that the rule of drug dealing?
Let me tell you how good I was.
Because you say you learned, in the book, you say, I don't condone people learning dealing drugs, but I learned a lot from doing it.
Well, you know, you have to be a people person to deal drugs, you know? And also, I dealt drugs in Europe. And I dealt drugs in Amsterdam in 1971, which was the drug capital of the world.
What were you dealing when you say drugs? Is it just a little weed or you have
heavy stuff? Or?
It went through, it started out with weed because everything started out like hippy dippy weed. Right. And then it all, and it went on through that mescaline, acid, STP, DMT.
I don't even know what half of those things are.
What was big in those days?
It was huge.
Those were huge.
So. I mean, DMT makes LSD look like.
What's that stand for?
Dimethyltryptamine, which is, incidentally, the chemical released in your brain at the exact moment of death. That is what happens when people say they see a light or blah, blah, blah. That's DMT. You have DMT. Every one of us has DMT in our bodies. It's only released at our time of death. So
you studied this shit you were selling, too. Look at this. It's like a pharmacist. Man.
If you ever did synthetic DMT, what you saw when you took it made LSD look like a walk in the park. But the thing is, DMT only lasts for a very short period of time. Thankfully, it only lasts about 10 minutes. And so you need people to sit on you while you're taking it, because otherwise you will just jump out of a freaking window.
I love this.
So I had guys sitting on my both arms and my chest when I did it, and my brain was thrust like an SST at takeoff without a windshield.
So much fun.
I love this.
Do it tonight.
And what you saw, I mean, I read Timothy Leary's writings after I did it, and I saw exactly what he saw. I was thrust into the temples in the Mayan temples in Mexico. I saw the hieroglyphics on the wall. If there's any connectivity that we have genealogically, anthropologically, to previous generations, it's there, because it was mind-blowing. And after I did acid about 250 times, which I also discuss in the book, I did it every day in the summer of 68 because I really wanted to learn how to take LSD correctly.
He looks like this. And is this
how
sharp?
You're alive?
How, yeah, exactly.
Well, look, on top of this, I was taking drugs into other countries. On top of it, I got busted twice, talked my way out of two drug busts. And finally, in 71, wound up as a house dealer at the Paradiso in Amsterham.
House dealer?
A house dealer.
It's insane. But here's the part about the drugs that I find the most entertaining. Yeah. And I've never done drugs, so I don't know anything what you're saying. But I can relate to this aspect of the drug thing. JJ says in the book that he loved the Grateful Dead when he was on drugs. And then as soon as he stopped doing drugs, He could never listen to Grateful Dead again. Yeah. Like, the Grateful Dead was only effective to him on drugs.
Well,
and after you stopped him, you realized it's a fucking terrible band.
I said, I saw the Dead 27 times, 26 times on acid, 27th time I saw him straight, and it was the worst fucking band I ever heard in my life. So I say that in the documentary, by the way. I do say that in the documentary, and I got an email from a guy who goes, "Hey, man, just watched your documentary. Saw what you said about the Dead," signed Justin Kreutzmann. I'm like, God, the Grateful Dead's drummer is Bill Kreutzmann. Could that be a relative? And I write, "Are you related to Bill?" He goes, "That's my dad." I went, "I'm so sorry." He goes, "No, dude, that was the funniest shit I ever heard in my life." And we became really close friends. He is on my podcast this week, Justin Kreutzmann, because he produced the Grateful Dead documentary, which I spent 5 hours watching because I wanted to see if there was some vestiges of LSD still creased in my brain.
Say,
still,
yeah, some sort of
relived the
trip
times.
Back.
Dude, let me tell you something. Jerry Garcia gave me a tab of acid at the Fillmore East. It really doesn't get more official.
No.
Only in the Fillmore can you go to a Dead concert. True story. Go in my pocket to take the acid as the band's about to go on. I drop the tab. I tell an usher, I dropped out there. He made everybody get up off their chairs. They're on the floor with flashlights going, "The dude dropped his acid. Couldn't find it. The band walked out. He walked over to Jerry. He went, blah, blah. Jerry gave him something, gave it to me.
I was born in the wrong time. Yeah. That's the bottom line. Those were the times to live.
You never
right
did drugs,
no,
did you?
No, I was never a drug
me
guy.
Neither.
It sounds like fun, though, Dad.
Yeah, except as I point out in the book, it all came crashing down in 72.
Of course,
big way.
Yeah.
In a big way, my girlfriend, my best friend, junkies, and I had to stop. No. I just got echoes in my...
Yeah, we're getting... Joel, channels are out, echoes. There's all kinds of stuff going on in here.
So now here I am totally straight, completely straight now.
Great.
And I'm auditioning for this Wicked Lester thing. And then I never heard from him again.
Really?
And I said, okay. So it didn't work out. I never thought twice about it.
So it actually never happened?
No, never happened.
Oh, wow.
I was never in Kiss or Wicked Lester. I just jammed with these guys. I'm assuming they must have jammed with 10 other guitar players, right? Nothing happened. Then I go, my last gasp, I spend the summer 72 in a hippie commune, and I'm living with a band that's doing Allman Brothers covers. And we did one show Labor Day weekend, and the band broke up. And then I'm sitting home doing nothing, twiddling my thumbs, thinking, what am I going to do? And I get a Bowie album in the mail with Fusion magazine, Lou Reed, Bowie, and Mötley Crüe. 1, 2, 3.
Wow.
Bing, bing, bing. I look up David Bowie, look at the pictures of Mick Ronson, and go, that's me. Cut my hair off, dye it blonde. And now I'm sitting around going, now what? And a friend of mine calls me and says, you should go see this band called The Dolls at the Mercer Arts Center.
I love this.
Well, I knew them because they used to rehearse at this place called Talent Recon on 8th Avenue and 50th Street. Now, they were guys in local bands that I knew in the city, and they were not good players at all. We kind of knew them. Nobody took Johnny seriously. We just didn't. Whatever. Newly glammed up, I go to the Mercer Arts Center. Dolls come out, look amazing, start playing, and it was like worse than the Grateful Dead. Like, it was fucking just awful.
You were on drugs or not at this time?
Totally straight. And I'm going, this is what I said to myself, and this is actually true. I walked out, and an executive, a guy in a suit, comes up to me, and he goes, oh, did you go see the Dolls? I said, yes. What'd you think of them? I'm assuming he's a record executive. And I said, do you want my honest opinions? Yeah, I said, they look amazing and they suck. I said, if they ever learn how to play, they'll probably become a very successful band. That was my quote, exactly my quote,
wow.
Okay? But I went back the next week. I saw him again. Between the two dates, David Bowie played at Carnegie Hall. I see Bowie. Ridiculous,
yeah.
Right? I mean, I saw him.
Of course.
No, they had no gimmicks. They just had a backdrop. They had no stage show, no nothing. They came out, they finished playing Chuck Berry songs, which, by the way, Trevor Boulder, when I met him many years later, said the reason why they did was they ran out of material. I love that. Okay?
Honest.
Yeah. Bowie's there. There's a picture of me and Bowie at Mercer Arts Center. He's sitting behind me.
Yeah.
I'm sitting in front of him. How did I get the picture? The guy who did the Twisted Sister.
I was going to say, how'd you get better seats than Bowie?
Well, because the girls that took me to see the Dolls lived with Bill and Syl the year before in England. And they were classmates of mine in George Washington High School, who, incidentally, is where Eddie Ojeda went. So me, Eddie Ojeda, and Jane Rabb, who was one of the girls that took me to see the dolls, Jane Rabb wound up being the producer of Sex and the City, Blue Bloods, and a ton of other TV shows. We're all schoolmates, and that was our little...
And Vicky Sue Robinson, right?
Well, Vicky, wow. A little later on. Wow. Well, Vicky Sue in the park. Yes, Vicky Sue and I used to hang out, get fucked up, and we fell asleep in Central Park at the fountain one night, and it was the day before I was to get a photo shoot for Ingenue magazine that was doing a feature on me as high school troublemaker. And I remember it was 10 o'clock in the morning, and I said to Vicky, I got to call my mom. She probably thinks I was murdered in the park. And my mother said to me, where were you? I said, I fell asleep in the park. She goes, well, you have a photo shoot at 10 o'clock this morning at Ingenue. I had to run down. And there's a photo of me from the photo shoot in the book. Anyway, we digress. So obviously, Eddie, you read the book, and obviously there's a lot of stuff going on, and we haven't even talked about Twisted Sister.
I love it.
Well, there
this
is
great
but
stuff.
The thing, and I told you when you gave me the book, I said, I want to read it before I talk to you, because that's helpful, obviously. But here's the best thing. One of my favorite stories in the book is the fact that you talk about the work Twisted Sister put in to building the career. As I said to people a bit younger, like Frank and myself and people listening, they think of Twisted Sister coming out early 80s, overnight success, whatever, not knowing the 10 years that went in prior to that and the countless amount of shows in the New York, New Jersey area and everything that you built. And you say that when people come up to you even now and say, hey, come check out my band, one of your first questions is, how many shows have you done? And if it's not a certain amount of shows, you're like, come back to me when you've done 300 shows or something, because you just feel like they haven't put the work in yet. It can't be there yet. But when you go into the stories about Twisted Sister and the early lineups and all the different versions of the band, it's a story that actually made me laugh out loud. And that's about when you shared the bill with a chimpanzee. And I'm not talking about a band called Chimpanzee. I'm talking about a chimp. And Twisted Sister opened for the chimp.
Yeah, we opened for the chimp, and the chimp went over better than we did, as a matter of fact. And, you know, as humiliating as that story is, I was sitting around with John Scher, the promoter.
Of course.
So John was working with an artist that I was managing. So I said to John, I said, how long have you been at the Capitol Theater? He says, this many years. And I said, I got to tell you the most humiliating story in my life. I said, Twisted Sister played with this chimp called Mr. Jiggs. And he goes, I used to book Mr. Jiggs at the Capitol Theater in Passaic. And I went, wait a minute. I went, you used to, he goes, yeah, I had Mr. Jiggs on a bill with Fleetwood Mac. I went, get the fuck out of here. Mr. Jiggs, I said, well, who headlined? He goes, well, Fleetwood Mac, of course. I said, well, we opened for the goddamn chimp. Okay. Now, I'm on the, Rogan, the other podcaster.
Carolla?
I'm on Adam's show. And he's asking, what's the most humiliating thing we ever did? I said, open for a chip. He finds a video of Mr. Jiggs performing. And it's exactly how and why he blew us off the stage.
What kind of act is that?
So what he did was, okay, the club was called Dodds in Orange, New Jersey. And the club had a bar that was the size of the perimeter of the club with probably a 4-foot wall that went around the bartenders in the middle. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Jiggs would get on top of the bar with a rolling liquor cart, and he would stop by girls and he would light cigarettes for them and mix them drinks. And he wore a tuxedo. So if you go online and look for Mr. Jiggs in the tuxedo, you will see this because Carolla pulled it up. I never saw it since
it happened.
I see Joe
typing right now, by the way.
Okay.
So,
love to see that.
So Mr. Jiggs really went over
Feel like a Mr. Jiggs reunion tour is in order, although I don't know how long chimps live. I don't think they have that lifespan.
Hey,
so Mr.
know.
Jiggs, I'm sure, is no longer with us, unfortunately.
Well, some fan said, dude, I saw you guys at Cardi's in Houston when male strippers opened for you. And I remember we were doing this tour early on the Can't Stop Rock and Roll tour, and we get to Cardi's in Houston, and the club, and we're in the back room, and I look outside, it's packed with girls. I said, this finally shifted over. It's packed. And then, of course, we realized the reason why it was packed with these hot chicks was because there was these male strippers. The minute they left, the girls all
of course.
Left us with 5 dirt bags in the room, you know.
The other revelation in the book is that there was a brief time in your life where you had a hit out on you. the clubs in New York were owned by...
Who are you?
Yeah, but those guys... But none of those guys took the hit out on me. It was taken out by a studio. Our threat of a hit was taken by a studio owner.
But you had to pay the money to get the hit taken off.
So you got a hit on them.
We had a copacetic understanding had to be made in order for the threat of the hit to be taken off.
Wow.
Because it had something to do with money that you borrowed money...
No.
Something to do with the record for the demo. And
what happened was the Under the Blade demos of Eddie Kramer were recorded at Electric Lady Studios.
Okay.
And you know how you do a studio deal where you go off the record, if the demos get signed, you do the album at the studio. That's a pretty standard
deal. Spec deal. Yeah.
It's a spec deal. That wasn't the issue. So we always understood that if we got a deal, but we never got a deal, so it didn't matter. So 3 years later, we decided since the demos didn't go anywhere and our fans, we were sick of saying we're going to get a deal and we weren't getting a deal. We made up our own record label, you know, Twisted Sister Records, just to print records out and give them out at clubs as a tchotchke, you know, like, hey, man, we have a record deal.
Yeah.
When we were signed to Secret Records, which was the Kramer tapes were in 79, so it was 81.
Bad name for a record company, by the way. You don't want your record to be a secret that it came out.
Well, it was such a secret, but we can come to that.
But, and the other name was Handshake Records.
Well,
that
was
it?
Many. There were many.
Those are two deals they had. Secret Records.
We had more.
And
we had X. We had X. We had Handshake. We had. Well, don't forget that Handshake had three. We don't jump from story to story. It's like a bunch of old Jews in Boca. You know, we can just finish the goddamn story you're talking about, because otherwise it's going to be like, for goddamn.
It's not a lot of time,
so,
JJ.
So the bottom line, let me just finish the stupid thing about the studio. So, of course, we don't have a record out. But what happened was the guys who printed the singles for us, the local Queens guys who printed the singles, you know, they thought they were doing us a favor by giving it to Sam Goody. So the owner of the studio walks down to Sam Goody and sees our record for sale. So he assumes we have a record deal. Being a record deal, he's now owed $25,000. And he calls us up and he says, I see you got a record deal. I said, well, no. He said, well, yeah. He goes, that's a record. He pulls out the single. He goes, that's a record. That's your name on it. You got a record deal. I want my $25,000. If I don't get it, I'm going to have to break your legs. I'm like, huh? Like, Mark Puma and I were in that meeting. I looked at Mark. I said to the guy, can you excuse us for a minute? We need to have a conversation. I walked out to her. I said, all the years and all the guys that I have dealt with, all these freaking dudes that we have dealt with that have dubious reputations. And to be clear, one of the clubs Henry Hill actually worked at. So it doesn't get much more.
He used to hang out on my radio show here in New York 20 years ago. Okay. Yeah. He used to hang out in the lobby.
Henry.
I had him up once. For real.
So anyway, you know, I said, this guy actually threatened to break my legs. What are we going to do? And so we spoke to, you know, Frankie the Shoe, Billy the Fork, Freddie the Knife, and, you know, and we negotiated a copacetic understanding that we were going to have to pay some money. It just so happened the secret deal did happen right when that happened, and they said, we'll give you a $10,000 advance, and so we just paid off.
Wow. All
right, one other thing here, because what I want to do is I want to, since Frank and JJ are both here, we'll take some questions for either of them if you'd like at 844-686-5863, 844-6-VOLUME. Of course, Frank Bello from Anthrax, his book is out now, Fathers, Brothers, and Sons. We talked about that at the top of the show, and JJ French of Twisted Sister we're talking to right now. But, you know, what's remarkable to me, 3 million records of Stay Hungry sold, and you guys go bankrupt. How does that happen? How does that, like, you, for people that don't, this is covered in JJ's book, but to have that amount of records sold at that time and that level of success.
It hurts.
You're selling stereos or something. D's doing whatever he's doing. That's still remarkable to me.
Well,
remarkable in retrospect.
Our record company chairman, Ahmet Erdogan, I didn't realize, but Ahmet Erdogan's Turkish for no royalties till 2048. That's number one. Secondly, putting all that aside, I say this in the book, there's three kinds of people in this world, the people who make it happen, the people who watch it happen, the people who say what happened. And 99% of the people go what happened, and a very small percentage watch it happen, and a very tiny group make it happen. I always was going to be the guy that either made it happen or watched it happen. I was never going to go what happened. So the fact that it happened was not a surprise to me.
The bankruptcy.
Or a shock to me.
Wow.
Really?
Not at all. Yeah, I go into
But in terms of sheer numbers, were you not getting paid what you were supposed to?
No, because it had nothing to do with the record deal. It had to do with us being sued by a merchandise company. For we took the largest advance at the time of Come Out and Play. The three biggest merch advances in history were paid to Madonna, Springsteen, and Twisted Sister.
Wow.
And we took that.
Amazing.
And then the tour tanked. And nobody in their right mind thought that they would actually come back for the money. Because in the record business, they gamble.
Mm-hmm.
And they gambled with Springsteen, and he made him $1 million. And they gambled with Madonna, and they made him $1 million. And we figured, okay, so it didn't work out with us. Big freaking deal. They write it off. Our lawyers said they're not writing it off. They want to come after you.
Because you didn't recoup the advance for
not
merch.
Even close.
Coming off of Stay Hungry, everyone would have been like, that's a no-brainer. That's a shoe-in, 3 million records. But nobody saw Come Out and Play tanking. And when it did, the whole bottom fell out on everything.
Well,
and they wanted their money.
That tanked. And then, of course, Love is for Suckers tanked even more. And then the energy ran out. As I detail in the book, and I'm going to say this up front so everybody understands this, the relationships between Dee, me, Mark, and Eddie are better than we've ever been. And we talk every day.
Cool.
And we do that because our songs are the most licensed songs in the history of heavy metal. We do that because every single day there's deals to be made with our songs. You could hate Twisted Sister all you want. We're not going to take it. It's the most famous heavy metal rock and roll anthem on the planet Earth. 2 days ago, I got a video from Honduras, where the president was using We're Not Going to Take It as his theme song running for president. I'm not going to get into the legality of how he can use it or not. That's not the point. The point I'm talking about is the worldwide recognition of this song. Someone sent me a video last week of the president of Spain using We're Not Going to Take It. 2 years ago, they were singing We're Not Going to Brexit on the steps of the parliament. We're talking about a song, along with I Want to Rock, which generates an enormous amount of income. And because we have these songs that are enormous, the band doesn't have to play, which is why the band kind of retired. So we have a niche that is very, very unique. Like Queen has We Will Rock You, We Are the Champions, and they're maybe the biggest songs of the 70s. I want to Rock and We're Not Going to Take It are the two most licensed songs of the 80s. We're very, very, very comfortable with that as part of our historical backdrop. The bankruptcies occurred way after all this other stuff happened, had nothing to do with the record label. And also, out of respect to the record label, after all the smoke cleared, they gave us back four of our albums for 20 years to do what we wanted to do with.
Wow.
So they made up for it in many ways, which I also go into the book. And that was because of personal relationships that we had with certain executives that wound up running the label, including Jason Flom,
by the way. So do you control Stay Hungry?
No.
That's the only one they didn't give you.
But we re-recorded it. Right. And our re-records are the ones
around
that we license.
Of course, sure.
Now, okay, do I think record labels are criminal enterprises? Yeah. Do I think that they set up slave labor, indentured servitude? Yeah. Do I think that the idea of a record label where you sign to a label, you make the record, you have to pay them back for it, and you still don't own it is not one of the most egregious, disgusting things on the planet Earth? Yes. However, we signed it. So did the Beatles. So did the Stones. So did Who's Zep, Floyd, Queen, and 400 billion other artists. Taylor Swift can go on scream about my masters are not mine. Get with it, man. Nobody owns them. 1/1,000,000,000% do. But here's the thing. The re-record clause on the contract was the only clause ever put in a contract that was pro-artist. And my theory behind that is they were so arrogant, the labels back in the 40s, they figured 5 years, who the hell wants to? 5 years after we sign a guy and they suck the blood out of him, nobody's going to want these guys, so who cares? Well, guess what? That clause is the free clause. So we say to people, re-record your songs. Re-record them. Sell your versions of them if you can. You have a right to do it.
Frankie, you guys did that with Bush. With Bush, right?
Yeah, it was great.
You did that with Bush and at one. Yeah, remember, wasn't that the record with Joey M. Bush on it too? Yeah.
It was, you know, it was a good way around it, JJ. That's the
and it's legal, and that's
it's
it.
Legal,
so. I got a phone call once from one of the presidents of our record label who said, "We're very disappointed you're selling your re-records." I almost fell off my chair. I put my teeth back in my mouth. I went, "Excuse me." I went, "You're disappointed?" I said, "The one clause that's pro-artist and you are." I said, "I'll tell you what, give me a check for $20 million. I will promise to never sell a re-record for the rest of my life."
So when they did that, did you guys try to sound like the original?
Exactly.
Exactly like
exactly.
The sounds, amps,
in fact,
everything?
In fact, the truth of that is, when we did the Still Hungry album, we re-recorded everything. Mm-hmm. And then we sent around the re-records, and people were turning them down. We're going, it sounds exactly, well, it was. It was a half step down. Ah, and so when the, we were comparing the two to see if they were going to buy it, they go, sounds out of tune to me because they don't know. We had to go back in the studio. We had to do A440 versions of it again. Yeah.
Wow.
All right, I want to get a quick call in here real quick, and then we want to talk to, because John in New York's been waiting a long time to get on the air. And then we're going to, JJ brought up something great during the commercial break that we absolutely need to cover, and I had it in my notes, and I want to get to it. But John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks. Anthrax, awesome band. Sorry, questions for JJ, though.
That's fine.
When you were heading over to, like, Amsterdam, and you did, and you were on your drug craze and all that stuff, were you financially set, or do you come from money?
No, Jeff? I come from money I made dealing. That was the good part of dealing. You made a lot of money in those days. And by the way, you know, life was inexpensive in those days, like really, really, really cheap. A lot of people don't know this. The reason why so many hippies went to Amsterdam in 1971 was because the airlines made a deal called Youth Fare to Europe, $200 round trip. So $200, and every low-life idiot that I knew in Central Park wound up in Amsterdam. So I thought I was getting away from them, and I get to Vondel Park, and there's every moron that I left back in New York is there. But to be in Amsterdam in 71, to be in London in 71 was the summer that Who's Next came out, Every Picture Tells a Story comes out, Sticky Fingers comes out. Back in those days, there was free concerts in the Hyde Park. There was music blasting out of everywhere. It was a great year to be 19 years old.
Great.
Well, real quick, when you were over there and you did all that crap, I mean, craziness on drugs, were you ever able to hang on to stuff that you bought, maybe like an album or any of that crazy shit that you have now?
Good question. I bought several European pressings of Hendrix albums and Stones albums, which I still have.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
It's good. That's actually great. Actually, good question, because I was at the Band of Gypsies. I was at the New Year's Eve show at the Fillmore that was turned to an album. So I have the French pressing of that. Awesome. I was at Madison Square Garden when the Stones did Yaya's Out. I have pressings of that. I was at the Fillmore when John Mayall did the Turning Point albums. I got pressings of that. So I was at a lot of places at the right place at the right time, and they were turned into live shows. It's a good question, though, because I did buy a bunch of records from there, including...
No musical instruments?
No, I brought a guitar with me at the time when I went over there. I think I had an SG. No, I had a Junior. I had a Les Paul Junior, which I brought with me and brought all through Europe and carried it with me.
Good job, man.
Thank you, John. Thank you. Appreciate you calling. You talk about that in the book, too. There's a difference between wanting to be a rock star and being a musician. And your thing was just like, hey, I always know I'm going to be an okay guitar player, but I'm fine with somebody else writing the songs. And I'm fine with this because you just wanted to make the dream happen. That was your thing. The sunglasses, the look, the glam thing that pulled you in, that's what it was about.
Well, I gave a quote from, again, Ahmet Erdogan said this to me once when I asked him, how is he successful with the label where he's a jazz guy and he has Zeppelin, all this. And he goes, and what he said to me basically was, success is easier if you don't mind who gets the credit. Now, that's a heavy statement to make. But frankly, I'm not a singer and I'm not a songwriter. I've never begrudged D's doing it. I mean, if I wasn't with him, I wasn't going to do it. So I always believe in collaboration. That's why I have a co-author in my book. I think collaborations are better. I think it helps you work better. And I certainly wouldn't be successful had it not been for Eddie and Mark and D and AJ. It just it never would have happened.
Frank, you also used a co-writer in your book. We mentioned it before, Joel MacGyver. How did that process work?
Well, Joel's the editor. He runs Bass Player magazine. I've known him for years. We've done...
But as far as actually writing a book with him and you...
Via Skype.
But he pulled these stories out of you?
Dude, he knows how to light a fire under my ass. And you know, it's weird. Once you do, you start the memories coming out. They just flow. And the great stories that you don't even think you have in your mind.
So it's almost
anymore.
Like for both of you, the co-writers actually served as almost an interviewer. And did they actually transcribe everything too and then put it in your words pretty much? Is that how it works?
Yeah, Steve is a writer. He's a professional author, bestseller, motivational speaker. So we're very much on the same wavelength. But I have also 15 years of diaries. So, that's really awesome. What's extraordinary. I have 15 years of diaries in which I can actually get dates, times, places, why things happened the way they did. So pretty much how I saw things were how things went. Because, you know, what was the story of the Motley Crue? Four different books, four different ways to look at it, four different stories. With Twisted, for the most part, my interpretations of what happened were pretty much the way it happened. But still in all, I'm sure everyone processes it their own way. But what Steve did was he basically looked at me like my wife would be and go, okay, enough. Like, can we move on to the next story? You know, like, this is a good story. This is not a good story. This won't help the flow of the book. Because if it was up to me, it would have been 19th volume history of the Jews. It just would have gone on and on and on and on. Like, my wife, this is what my wife says about the book. She goes, I'm so fucking glad you have a book. Because the next time we have a dinner party and someone asks you a fucking question about your band, I'm going to say, here's the book. Here's his email.
She's going to have a box of them ready.
She goes, email him any questions and let's fucking talk about it. Anything
but it is. Hey, while we're talking about writers, this is a guy we need to bring up and talk about here for a second with the few minutes we have left, and that is Malcolm Dome. The music world was stunned and saddened and shocked a few days ago when we learned that Malcolm Dome passed away. Now, if you don't know who Malcolm is, that's understandable, especially being a U.S. audience, because Malcolm Dome was British. He was a writer in England. He was without a doubt one of the most respected writers in rock music. I grew up reading Malcolm Dome because Kerrang! Magazine was my Bible as a kid. I would drive, as soon as I got my license, I'd drive to the Import record store and buy it every week, every 2 weeks. That's where I first discovered Malcolm. Later on, I met Malcolm a couple times when I was working for labels. We would bring him over to do some stuff. Up until his death, he was very active still in covering bands, writing books.
Always into it.
Incredibly celebrated writer and great writer, British writer in the world of rock music. And JJ, you were saying that Twisted Sister has a greatest hits coming out and Malcolm contributed to it.
Yeah, he contributed the liner notes. In fact, he has the final quote on the album jacket. Last May, I called him. I said, I need some stuff. He said, no problem. Sent me these beautiful quotes. There's six quotes. One from each member of Twisted and one from Malcolm, and six stories, and the last one's from Malcolm.
So cool.
He made us, all of us, better. He championed metal before metal broke. The new wave of British heavy metal could be laid at his feet in a lot of ways. Maiden, of course, would say that AC/DC would say it.
Maiden put out a big statement about Malcolm.
I mean, my God, you know, it breaks my heart. This guy was the heart and soul of what we were in that period of time. And when I go back to ours being signed by Secret Records, no kidding. All jokes aside, the crew of Malcolm Dome, Pete Way, Lemmy, those guys around us is what gave us the credibility to break in England, and they're all gone.
Yeah,
and it breaks my heart.
Yeah,
yeah. He was a really accomplished writer and a great guy. I know Frankie's written a lot with you, done a lot of pieces on you guys as well.
Yeah, he's been great to Anthrax. Always rest his soul. I had no idea. He was
Nobody
even
knows
sick.
What happened. Yeah, nobody. I had no idea. It came as a huge shock. We don't know if it was a sudden thing or something that he was dealing with that we didn't know about. But what the bottom line is, he's gone. And anybody in the that's a British rock fan or artist or anybody based there, any artist, American or British, you certainly know Malcolm and his contributions. He was a giant in the world of rock journalism.
He will be missed.
He will. Susan in New Mexico. Hey, Susan.
Hey, Eddie. Nice to hear. Thanks for letting me on. I just want to say, JJ, love Twisted Sister, one of my favorite bands. I was glad you mentioned Slade. Slade is actually one of my all-time favorite bands. Love them. And Eddie, you know.
Susan, I think Susan's radio is up in the background and it's confusing her. But thank you, Susan, for your call.
The soap opera.
Slade is one of those bands that they're just not known in the U.S. They're just not. If they're known in the U.S., they're known because Quiet Riot had hits with one of Quiet Riot's biggest song is a Slade tune.
Can I also want to add this with much respect to Kiss. So in September of 72, Gene called me I called him to find out if they had got a guitar player because they were still advertising. And they said, no, we have a guy. His name is Paul Fraley. And would you like to come down and hear the band with him? And I went, sure. And he said, give us a couple of weeks. And they invited me to the loft. And I went to the loft the day that they played the Kissified versions of Wicked Lester songs for their producer, Ron Johnson. So the only people in the loft were me, Ron Johnson, and my friend Tommy, who escorted me down there. And we sat there, and there was Kiss, and you could tell the Kiss logo was on a bed sheet, and they had Marshall amps, which they didn't have before. American bands did not play Marshalls in those days. They did not. They used Fenders. They used other shit. And they played Kissified, and I went, wow. Look at the Dolls. They don't know who the hell they are. You look at this. This, they know what they're doing, so it doesn't surprise me.
All right, we got a few minutes left to go, just literally a few. JJ, any promotional stuff you want to mention before we have to run out of time for the book or Twisted or
well,
anything?
Really quick, the book really is about the Twisted method of reinvention. That's really what the book is. It's a biz war. It's a business book and a memoir, and it's about the Twisted method of reinvention, which basically speaks to the fact that Twisted Sister was turned down more times than a bedsheet in a whorehouse, and we've come back more times than Freddy Krueger and Michael Myers. I mean, that's really the whole story of Twisted Sister, and it's how we continue to come back over and over and over again and why we're still here 50 years later.
Are you coming back again?
Well, you
are
know
you coming back
come on,
again?
Baby, come we on, have,
there,
do this.
There are no, there's. I don't know if there's enough ibuprofen to have me.
Dude, put, with the new look. The new look is everything. You know? That's the new look, dude. Come on.
So I don't know. But we talk every day. We do talk great. Every day. We get along great. Everyone loves each other.
They're
and
great.
We're there to support each other. And we're wonderful. And right now, the only thing is with Twisted, we have a double vinyl record for vinyl collectors coming out November 17th. It's going to be a colored vinyl. It's going to have one album is going to be the Greatest Hits Studio, and the other is going to be Greatest Hits Live, some of the best shows from England. That's why Malcolm wrote some of the liner notes in it. So get that as well. And get all the stuff for Christmas, including Frank's book, too, since we're here to help you.
And
I
you can see
that.
Frank on Friday if you're in New York City.
Yes.
What's the name of the place
Revolution
again?
Revolution Records.
Revolution
oh,
Records.
I'll be there the day after.
7
are
o'clock.
You doing it right after?
I'm doing it right after. I'm doing it. I'm on Saturday. Yeah. Well, excuse okay. me. Are you, what day are you doing it?
Friday. Friday
I'm doing
night.
It Saturday.
So oh, Friday and Saturday. Weekend at Revolution
weekend
Records.
Weekend at Revolution Records.
Oh, Generation
in New York.
Records.
Oh, Generation. Why
generation.
Did I say Revolution? I screwed up. I've been saying
place.
The whole. I'm sorry. I should have looked at my freaking phone.
Generation.
Thank you for correcting. I'm an idiot.
Thank you, JJ. This guy's giving
the wrong place.
Dude, I took some of the drugs that you brought.
Exactly.
But yes, Generation. Sorry, Generation. They're gonna cancel
7
me.
O'clock Friday.
Friday
Frank
generation.
Generation Records in New York City.
And you blew it.
Saturday, JJ is there. Same time, 7
I think
o'clock?
Six, I think 6. On,
6 o'clock.
Seven, I can't.
JJ's a little older. He's got to get out. He's got to get done sooner.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Eddie. Okay. Well,
not by much, but just a little. Yeah, what, you got Anthrax shows coming?
Sometime. Go to anthrax.com. I have no idea. I'm concentrating on one thing at a time, dude.
What's by the way, say the hi to Mike Monterullo for me.
Of course. Right? He's probably listening right
okay.
now. Of course.
Right.
I will
what's,
do that, of
what's
course.
What's going on with the record?
I can't talk about it. Not a lot. Dude.
Who are you all of a sudden can't
dude,
talk about
I'm very,
it?
Very private. I'm very private
person.
Get
out of here.
What is this? What is this, the end of a James Bond movie that you can't talk about?
Are you writing or not?
Yeah, we're writing. I'm going,
did you
I go next, I'm going next Tuesday to,
did you record?
To Charlie's house. We're writing a record.
All right.
Not recording. We're very
all cryptic.
Because they all get on my ass. Why'd you say all this stuff about the band? I got to hear them all the fucking time.
Well, my thanks to JJ and my thanks to Frank. Great, great friends, and great to see them in person and hang with them in the studio in New York City. As you guys know, on the radio show, I work from all over the place, home studio, Vegas, Los Angeles, New York, from the road, wherever that my travels take me. But it was fun to be back in the New York groove, as they say, with two original New Yorkers in Frank Bello and JJ French. Hope you enjoyed that conversation. Remember, follow me on social media at Eddie Trunk for info and updates. Listen to Trunk Nation on volume Sirius XM 106 Monday through Friday live 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Talking rock with you. That's where all these interviews originated from. Have yourselves a great week, everybody. Hope to see you out there on the road. If not, back here next Thursday for another podcast and hopefully on the radio as well. Have a good one.